good morning. Welcome to Jay's Talk Plus. I'm Julia Kreutz. Blake Murphy today is taking a break. So alongside me for this show is Sho Ali. Sho, thank you so much for doing this. I'm glad we get to talk about a win. I am glad that we're doing this on a Friday ahead of a weekend filled with baseball. How are you doing? And again, thank you for being here.
Yeah, always fun when we get to be on together, Jules. I promise it's a Friday. I promise I won't mail it in. But I
can't make that promise.
Yes, that's fair. I won't hold it against you. No, it's fun when I get to do this with you. And I agree with you. It is so much fun being able to do this after a massive win over the Phillies. A massive series win over the Phillies. Not just the 9-1 win yesterday, but taking the series. I mean, you and I did Jay's Talk on the weekend. And I said to you then that, like, I'm not sure... You know, you enjoy a win over the A's. You win four straight against any team. You'll take it 1,000%. But, you know, I think a lot of people view this series against the Phillies as a litmus test of sorts. And, gosh, I mean, it's hard not to be at least a little more optimistic about the Blue Jays after taking a series from one of the best teams in baseball.
I know. Do they look like a playoff team right now? They kind of do, right? They kind of played like that. Obviously, it didn't start like that with the way the Tuesday went and Bowden Francis' struggles.
Sure.
Sort of continuing, but the Blue Jays bounce back, a walk-off win on Wednesday night, that fabled Alejandro Kirk RBI single against Jordan Romano, in which Jeff Hoffman ended up as the winner of that game, Romano ended up as the loser, which we could not have drawn it up any better. And then yesterday, just a blowout win, 9-1, they chase his Luzardo out of the game. Chris Bassett delivers seven very strong innings to bounce back himself. My question for you before we dive into all of this, since we're doing the show today,
Okay. Can
this 9-1 win factor into our record of talking about the Blue Jays, whether that's post-game or, you know, I guess you could consider this post-game, right? Where do you stand on that?
That's a good question. You know what? As much as I would like to claim it, I'm going to say no. I would have to say no on that one. Blair and Barker did like an hour Jay's Talk last night, so I feel like I'd be like shortchanging them to a certain extent. So I'm gonna have to say no. Although I will say you and I are doing Jay's Talk, I think, on Sunday. So yeah. I am hoping for a win at least on Sunday. I'm hoping for a win in all of these games against the Twins, but certainly on Sunday.
Another tough test for the Blue Jays against the Twins coming up this weekend series, which starts today at 8:10 PM, I wanna say. That is in Minnesota. And you said it, Sho. We were all, you know, pretty satisfied, pretty happy about the way that things went against the A's. You couldn't really be feeling any other way if you were a Blue Jays fan. The offense came alive. We got some very, very good pitching performances from Jose Berríos and others in that series. And then as we turned the page to the Phillies, the conversation changed a little bit. And it was more about, okay, can they do that or something close to that against elite pitching? Well, so far so good. Maybe Tuesday was not, you know, the breakout for this team, but as they bounce back and get that walk-off win, maybe create a bit of a different mentality coming into the last game of the series, they win the series and they win it in pretty convincing fashion. So you were working the game yesterday. What did you make of the way that the bats sort of attacked, and especially the fact that, you know, most of the contributions came from the bottom of the lineup, from the role players? Where do you stand with how the contributions have come from this Blue Jays team up and down, really?
Yeah, I mean, I've loved what I've seen from Miles Straw, from Tyler Heineman. It's so funny, Miles Straw has been... I mean, and maybe this is a little unfair, but I do understand why people viewed him this way. But Miles Straw was almost viewed as like the personification of not being able to get Roky Sasaki, right? I think that's how a lot of people viewed him. The salary was a huge, it was quite a large number, right? Well over $10 million. I mean, this is a guy who's won a Gold Glove, but last year with Cleveland spent most of the year in the minors. So you kind of thought to yourself, all right, like they're really only getting Miles Straw in order to accommodate some kind of trade for or a signing of Roky Sasaki. And then that didn't happen. And I think it made the Blue Jays look like they had egg on their face. Mm-hmm. And I got to say, I mean, considering the bar was pretty much on the ground for Miles Straw, I think it's been very easy for him to outperform expectations. But I've been very, very impressed with him all season. And yeah, there were some moments where I think, you know, questionable choice to have him pinch hit for guys. also, to be fair, I mean, he's one of the very few outfielders who, funnily enough, has a right-handed bat. Yeah. I mean, like, most of the outfield, apart from George Springer, are left-handed bats. So, and now with guys on the IL, you're kind of making do, right? But Class A, of course, a switch hitter. But yeah, I got to say, I've been very impressed with Miles Straw. Tyler Heinemann continues. I think there's some batted ball luck that I think goes his way. And we saw that. We even saw that last night or yesterday afternoon with the ball that clanks off of Trey Turner's glove.
Maybe some official scoring luck.
I do think so, right? But again, that's not to take away anything from Tyler Heinemann. Yeah, he's still putting good swings on the ball, and he's making great contact. So if you can get that kind of production from the bottom of the order, and I mean, sometimes I hesitate to include Ernie Clement and Addison Barger in, like, quote-unquote, like, bottom-of-the-order discussions, but, I think it depends on where they're batting. Certainly, yesterday, Barger, definitely not in the bottom of the order, but, you know, you're getting very good contributions from parts of the lineup where even just last year you got no production from virtually, right? So that has turned around for the Blue Jays this year. I got to say, it leaves you in a pretty good place.
It's funny that you mention Miles Straw. Just the other day, someone asked John Schneider pregame about what they have seen from Miles Straw, and the fact that this was a guy who did not spend a ton of time even in the majors last year, right? He signed a big contract. He struggled. And what Schneider said was, listen, you know, you get the big contract. You put up the big numbers to sort of set yourself up, and then you spend most of the year in AAA, you're kind of forced to figure some things out about yourself, to kind of look inward and think about things in a different way. And I think what we're seeing a little bit here is that process as well for Miles Straw, to sort of look inward, figure out, okay, what is it that has made me successful in the past? How can I get there again? And he is one of the guys who is going to give credit to the Blue Jays hitting staff and coaching staff and all of that, and rightfully so. And something else that Schneider mentioned that was very interesting was that Miles Straw is low-key becoming just like a clubhouse favorite.
Okay.
A guy with an interesting sense of humor, a guy who's kind of, you know, he's quiet, but he's kind of always there. And you know that you can chat with him about pretty much anything.
Have you interviewed Miles Straw before?
I have tried.
Okay,
that's actually, it's funny you would ask me that. I have tried to interview him like 3 times and the timing never works. Where it's like, I go up to him and he's like, I just have to go to a meeting or I am due for whatever in the
cage.
Sounds
like he's dodging you, Julia.
Maybe he is, but he's always so nice about it. He's like, I'm so sorry. Like, I keep missing you. I know that this has happened a few times. Yeah. I'm like, it's all good. I mean, you know, but yeah, maybe he is dodging. He's just being very,
very polite about it.
So Miles Straw, obviously a big contributor, went 2-for-4, 2 RBIs yesterday. You mentioned Tyler Heinemann, 3 RBIs.
Yes.
For Heinemann. And again, a good job behind the plate as well. He was obviously catching Chris Bassitt, and we're going to talk about Chris Bassitt for a little bit, but so important to also have sort of a veteran catcher. And I know that he hasn't caught that much in the majors throughout his career, but he's been around for a long time. And you kind of can see that. And you can see that in his at-bats, too, right? He is a guy who kind of understands the, if you put the ball in play, good things happen tenet of baseball. And that is very much what we saw from Heinemann yesterday. Davis Schneider was back in the lineup. He got a hit. A couple of runs scored. He walked as well. Ernie Clement, 2-for-4. And then there was Bo Bichette. And for all the contributions that we got from this bottom of the lineup, there is nothing quite like seeing Bo Bichette unload on a sweeper that doesn't break, and he takes it the opposite way. What can we make of the way that Bo Bichette has been swinging the bat right now? Since hitting that first homer, it seems like the floodgates have just been open for Bo.
Yeah, I mean, he hadn't hit many, if any, of his home runs prior to the month of May. And so pretty much all of his power has come since the beginning of May, which is pretty incredible. I mean, it's hard not to look at what Bo is doing and say, compared to what it's hard to not look at anything he does and compare it to last year and say he's having a better year than last year, considering he had, like 3 or 4 separate injuries, like the calf strains, the neck spasms, the broken finger at the end of the year. So I think by and large, he was all, you know, I think a lot of people tabbed him to have at the very least a bounce back season if he just remained healthy. And he is doing far more than that, right? And it's interesting, too, because Bo has never been, you know, like the biggest power threat. And when it comes to home runs, right, I think his career high home run wise is 29. So 29 home runs, like, don't get me wrong, nothing to sneeze at. You're not going to like scoff or turn your nose up at 29 home runs. But at the same time, I think you do want to see, or you did want to see at the very least prior to May, Bo get back to himself in terms of smashing hard hit doubles. That was something we got used to seeing prior to last year. Obviously, this is a guy, when healthy, who is going to be close to the league leader or the AL leader at the very least in hits. Even if he was just putting good contact on the ball. And that's just not something we had seen virtually at all last year. Yep. And I had said to you before when we were doing the post games that I would simply take Bo just making good swings, doubles into the gap, even if he ends plays with him standing on second base, even if runs scored or not, I would take that from Bo. And you're starting to see the power come around, right? Because it's not really about him getting on base at this point for me, because he does that at such a high clip already. It's the slugging. And I think you are starting to see that come around, which I think I do believe is sustainable, right? And again, I mean, you do need that for this team to be successful. I mean, we can talk about the bottom of the order all we want. Yeah. It's this team is going to go as far as Bo takes you. It's going to go as far as Vladdy takes you. It's going to go as far as certainly Santander and Varsho take you. Those guys are on the IL for now. So in their absence, I think you kind of need Kirk with the walk-off you mentioned. You're going to need more from him, and you've gotten more from him. But you definitely need more from Bo and Vladdy. And Bo, I think, he has stepped up lately.
Yeah, it's funny because he's been hitting since the season started.
Right.
That's unquestionable here. But one term that Blake used a lot early on to talk about Bo is, yeah, he's hitting 290, but it's a pretty empty 290.
Sure, okay.
There wasn't a whole lot there. Yeah, he was getting on base, and he seems to be just like the most effective, unconventional leadoff hitter right now in the league. That's working, right? For whatever reason, it's working for the Blue Jays. But like you mentioned, sort of the hard hit balls, the using the entire field, that is his game. And maybe that is what was missing a little bit. But now it seems like everything that he hits is hard. Everything that he hits has a chance to either get out of the ballpark, or it's an extra base hit. And that is the most important thing. He's on a 9-game hitting streak right now. He's slugging 7.78 during that period. So you can see that there's nothing empty about that, right? And perhaps the most surprising or impressive part of all this is that he still leads this team in RBI.
Sure.
As the leadoff hitter. And maybe that also speaks to the bottom of the lineup and the contributions that they're giving you. Obviously, Tyler Heineman scored on his on Bo's homer yesterday. But listen, you look at last year, and he was even, you know, kind of honest about that postgame yesterday and saying, we all know that this is, I couldn't play to the best of my ability. I couldn't play last year. But now he's looking like he's settling again. Frankly, couldn't come at a better time, right? This is a contract year for this guy.
There was a moment in the post game yesterday which made me chuckle. And it's funny because Blair referred to it on Jay's Talk. It was very like Austin Matthews-esque, which I laughed at because Bo is just very like, he's a man of few words,
yes.
Right? He's not going to really give you 10 words when 5 words will do. That's just how he is. That's not because he's like a grumpy guy or anything. He's just a man of a few words, right? And there was a moment last night where he was asked about hitting the ball hard and like, oh, is this a new thing for you? And he like firmly rejected that premise, right? He was just like, nope, I've always hit the ball hard. And that was it. I don't think he said really a lot more than that. And
he has a point, right?
He is not wrong, right? And so it's good to see Bo get back to himself, both with the media and certainly in game. Are you at a point where you would, if you were the Blue Jays GM, I've now promoted you to Blue Jays GM,
okay.
Julia. So congratulations
does
on the pay raise.
Does it come with a pay raise?
It does, yes. Yeah, it's hard not to, right? For it to come with a pay raise. But I've now promoted you to Blue Jays GM. Do you open discussions with Bo and his camp for an extension?
Yeah, that's, oh my God, that is the question. We got that from the, on the text line yesterday too. Should we see at least some movement that? I don't know. Like, I personally think you should, because you don't actually right now have, or the Blue Jays don't seem to have, a sustainable succession plan. And listen, Bo Bichette is never going to be a top 10 shortstop in this league, I don't think, unless something, you know, changes, which it can, but that's not necessarily what he's there for. And how are you going to replace the offensive production? This is arguably your best hitter right now. I would put him above a guy like Vladdy, or even and Alejandro Kirk, who has given them so many clutch hits. And we can talk about Kirk in a little bit as well. But how are you going to replace that? Where are you going to find that? Yeah. Blue Jays are struggling still to score runs as it is. And I know that we're seeing the offense somewhat turn a corner here. And it's kind of a waiting game to see if there is consistency to that, if they can continue to put up, you know, runs on the board. More than two or three is what I'm talking about. And Bo has been a huge part of that renaissance. So I think they should. We haven't heard anything about that.
Yeah.
Even, you know, when Vladdy signed his extension, I believe it was Hazel who asked Bo, have you had extension conversations with the Blue Jays? And he said no. And listen, he understands. He said at the time, the priority is to sign Vladdy. We all understand that and kind of go from there. But they hadn't had those conversations with Bo. So I would say it's about time. I don't know if you're with me on that. What are your thoughts on a potential Bo extension here?
I mean, certainly I think it should get done, because I'm with you that it doesn't really feel, Jules, that your point about internal replacements at the very least, right? It doesn't really feel like there's someone waiting in the wings. That's not to slight Arjun Namala by any means. It's just he's really young, right? I mean, I don't think, like, if Bo were to leave in the offseason, I don't think you can necessarily reliably right now, and as much as I really want Arjun Namala to succeed, but I'm not sure, like, for 2026, you can say, well, the starting shortstop in the tournament Blue Jays is going to be Arjun Namala. It's possible that's the case in, like, 2028, maybe? 2027, maybe at the earliest, honestly? Even that feels like you're getting out in front of your skis too much. So if he is not the short-term answer, I mean, I guess next year, if Bo walks, I mean, who's the most likely candidate internally to be the shortstop? I guess, like, Jimenez, I suppose,
yeah,
right?
Maybe.
And I'm not sure. That would probably be great from a defensive standpoint, probably not the answer from an offensive standpoint. So I'm with you. I think there are not a lot of great internal options. I think the question is simply, how much money is Bo going to see on the open market? I mean, it's the same conversation we had about Vladdy, right?
Yeah.
And I think most shortstops, if not all of the shortstops that got major deals in the last, like, even just, like, 3 to 4 years, have all, I think, tested free agency, mm-hmm. right? And a good chunk of them have switched teams. I mean, Trey Turner, Francisco Lindor. I mean, he got his deal after he was traded, of course, but Dansby Swanson,
that's
yeah.
Right.
Xander Bogaerts, right? He signed that big deal with the Padres after leaving the Red Sox. I mean, there's a lot of guys you can go down the list and who got big money. Corey Seager, of course. That was a couple of years prior. It was in 2022, I want to say. So those are just the names that come to the top of the head. They all made bank,
yeah.
essentially,
yeah.
right? So I'm curious to see what Bo gets. I think Willy Adames was last year's big shortstop, and he got less than $200 million. I'm really curious. He's also a little older than Bo. Mm-hmm. So I'm curious to see what the market looks like, because if we're being honest, I mean, shortstops, just generally speaking, are, you know, I think positionally in higher demand than most other positions. And I think, too, I mean, if Bo goes to market and he says to teams, his agency, his team says to other franchises that he's willing to play second or third down the road, I mean, that also, I would imagine, opens his market way more than
right.
just teams that are only looking for a shortstop, right?
Yes.
So I'm really curious what it looks like for him. I do think the Blue Jays obviously would be better off with Bo Bichette than not
yeah.
because of all the reasons you laid out, but it's high time they start having these discussions if at least they haven't already.
Yeah, it's... We'll see, but I think that you and I have also had this conversation during a post-game show, which is, I have no idea what a Bo contract would look like.
Sure, yeah, yeah.
Right? In the open market, because there still, I would say, is no guarantee that he can remain a shortstop for the rest of his career, and we're assuming that he will want to sign a lucrative and long-term deal.
Right.
And but then you look at the offense, right? And the fact that the offense is still there, and you last year didn't give us much data at all, but he's looking like himself again, and maybe even more, right? Because he is showing up in ways that maybe are a bit new. The opposite field home runs are a very good development. They do mean that he, in my mind at least, that he's putting the ball in the air with a bit more consistency, and he is hitting the ball a little bit harder. Let's just put it like that, so as not to upset Bo here. A little bit harder than we've seen him do before. A lot of those batted balls, maybe a couple years ago, would have just hit the wall, and that's a double, right? But they're going out this year,
yeah.
And so maybe that also indicates another step forward. He's very young. his prime is probably still ahead of him. And maybe what we're seeing right now is, you know, just a movement towards that. I don't know if you're with me here.
No, I think I'm with you too. I mean, too, last year, and again, I feel like it's so easy just to throw out 2024 because of the injuries. So, and he said that, I think we all felt last season that when you look ahead to his career, whether it's with the Blue Jays or not, post 2025, that everyone was going to look back on 2024 and say, wow, that was a real outlier. It was an aberration. It wasn't the norm, right? And I think him, the fact that we are at what, June 6th, and we're having this conversation, I think proves that that will likely be the case going forward, right? But at the same time, I mean, you talk about what a Bo contract could look like. I mean, he is 27, or at least will be 27 when he signs his right, the big deal. Like, let's say whether it's with the Blue Jays or someone else between November and February, I got to think, at some point in the next year or so. And if you're comparing him to other guys who have signed deals around the same age, right? Corey Seager was, I think, roughly the same age when he signed that mega deal with the Rangers. And that was 10 years, $300 million, I want to say, thereabouts. So the point being, like, the AAV for Bo, if that's what you're looking at,
yep,
is between $28 to $30 million. And I do think there's still a ways to go for him this year before you get into the $28 to $30 million range from an AAV perspective, right? I mean, maybe right now you are looking at the Willy Adames deal, which I think was like 7 years, $185 million thereabouts. So, like, there's a big gulf between 7 years, $185 and 10 years, $300 million, right? So, and there's a lot of money in between. So you're probably looking for more than Adames. I mean, I'm sure Bo's camp is saying, hey, we want what Seager got. Right. We want what Trey Turner got. But I think you do want to see him do it a little bit more. Also on the defensive side, which, to be fair to Bo, has gotten better over the years. But I think you want those things to be more consistent before you get up to those, like, pretty lofty numbers.
I'll tell you who's already locked in and getting a ton of love, even from the text line here, is Alejandro Kirk.
Ooh,
we got a text from Dale in Nova Scotia saying, the Kirk signing was a great move by Ross. I've been critical of Kirk for all the runs his base running cost the team, but I think his catching and hitting skill far outweigh this. And listen, three more hits for him yesterday. He's hitting the ball as hard as anyone on this team. The Bo homer was not even the hardest hit ball of the game, because one of Kirk's three singles yesterday was 107 point something off the bat. I think that's the big development. And I know that, you know, we can talk about the defense as well, but with the way that the season started for Alejandro Kirk, where it was getting tough to watch those at-bats, it seemed like there was not much there, then just, boom, he turned it around. He's hitting the ball hard. He's not going to be a big home run guy, but he seems to be producing pretty much every time he is in the game. How impressed are you, or maybe how surprised are you, with the turnaround for Alejandro Kirk here?
Yeah, gosh, Jules, this is the best Kirk has looked since he was the starting catcher in the All-Star game in 2022, essentially, right? I mean, even that season, post All-Star break, he had a bit of a downturn, right? So things kind of went on the downward trajectory the following year. I think that was the year he started camp late, and then he didn't particularly get off to the greatest of starts. Last year was also like an all right year, I think, at the best of times. So this year, I think you expected more. I think the most surprising thing for me with Kirk is not only the fact that he's hitting the crap out of the ball. And I mean, with two strikes and two outs, he is statistically one of the best hitters in all of baseball, not just on this Blue Jays roster,
really
not
impressive,
just in the American League, but in all of baseball, he is one of the best hitters with two strikes and two outs. I mean, some would call that clutch.
Yeah.
I know that's hard to define,
yes,
but I think that's one of the best ways to define it. But he's also, I think, doing this while shouldering the majority of the catching load. And I remember I had a conversation before the season started on one of our shows on the network with Caleb Joseph, and Caleb, a former catcher. And we were talking about, all right, like, what do you expect offensively from Kirk if he's going to be like the man, right? Because how many guys in modern baseball go out and catch like 115 games or something like that and still are one of the upper echelon offensive catchers in baseball? I dare say very few,
yeah,
right?
Seriously.
Like even like JT Realmuto, Salvador Perez, who has largely transitioned away from catching in recent years. I mean, Will Smith with the Dodgers. Like, these are some of the names we've gotten used to talking about in across all of baseball. And Kirk is doing what they're doing from a defensive perspective, handling pitching staffs, and hitting the baseball really well. I think he's looked phenomenal. I've been very, very impressed. I was a little reticent to believe in it like a month ago, but he just keeps doing it. I've been incredibly impressed.
Honestly, same, because we knew from data from past seasons that his numbers took a dip when he had to catch the majority.
Yeah, and that's understandable, right?
It is. It's totally understandable. It's a very demanding position. There's a reason why teams are always looking for catching depth. And the fact that he has not maintained, but actually surpassed everything that we were expecting from him is a very good sign. Still early in the season, I will say. You kind of need to see if this is sustainable by any means, because as you said, even in the All-Star year, there was a dip in the second half of the season. So that remains to be seen, but so far so good. The Blue Jays will take the production and they'll take the series wins in the way that they are coming. I will read one more text before we take a break. I know we spoke. Oh, yeah, there we go. I know we spoke about Miles Straw, but this is a nice one.
And okay, sure.
So Chris in Regina saying, can we give some love to Miles Straw? How stress-free is it for Schneider to lose Varsho and have a Gold Glove center fielder that he can insert in there, and also who also knows his role offensively? That's, I think, the biggest thing, right, Joe? It's that Miles Straw understands that he's a bench player and he understands his role. He's thriving in whatever it is that the Blue Jays ask of him.
Yeah, I agree with Chris too, because I remember reading, this is before the season started, and I don't think this has happened very many times, if at all, as a Blue Jay, but I remember reading before the season started that Miles Straw, in terms of misplays on balls, routes to balls, errors, when he is in center field patrolling that distance in the outfield, he has had, I think, no errors in like hundreds of games, like literally hundreds of games, which I think is one of the best marks, not just in all of baseball, but I think in like decades, essentially, of someone being out there as often as Miles Straw has been. And I can't really tell you, I can think of too many misplays in center field, other than when there just been a minute, maybe a miscommunication with someone a little less experienced out there in like left field or right field.
Yeah.
But Miles Straw has been great. I mean, he is easily the best fielder on the team outside of Andrés Giménez. But if you're talking about outfield, easily the best fielder on the team outside of Dalton Varsho. So definitely a luxury for John Schneider to have to put out there and stay true. I know we get sick of talking about like run prevention and defense, but it is actually a pretty good thing for John Schneider to have. By the way, before we hit a break, on Kirk, I know Cal Raleigh is probably going to be the starting catcher for the All-Star team. I mean, it's a fan vote thing, so I suppose Blue Jays fans could easily vote Kirk into the All-Star game. But I got to think Kirk, no matter what, is worthy of an All-Star bid this year.
Yeah, I think so. And that push is about to start.
Yeah.
So we'll see how many of these Blue Jays actually make it to the All-Star game. Kirk, a very good candidate. So we're going to take a break. And when we come back, we're going to talk to Gord Ash, Brewers VP of Baseball Projects, Canadian Baseball Hall of Famer, former Blue Jays front office man. That should be a fun chat as well. As Jays Talk Plus continues with Julia Kreutz and Sho Ali filling in for Blake Murphy.
Big opinions and in-depth conversations covering the Leafs, Jays, Raptors, and the NFL. The J.D. Bunkus Podcast. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus with Julia Kreutz. Alongside me today is Sho Ali, filling in for Blake Murphy. He's getting a much deserved break, I would say. Show Blake Murphy.
We'll see.
That boy works a lot. We're happy for him that we get to give him a break today on this Friday. He gets a long weekend. We get to hang out a little bit more before Sunday, which is when I'm back with you for pre and post game. You're on pre and post game today as well. It's a pretty long day for you.
Pulling double duty. Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. We got the pregame on the radio on Sportsnet 590 The Fan locally at 7:30, and then postgame as well. Blair and Barker are doing Blue Jays Central this weekend.
Yeah.
They got pulled in for double duty as well. We're all pulling double duty these days.
A little bit of a rejigging of the roster here, as is also the case for the Blue Jays as they try to fill in that rotation spot that is still open by obviously the injury to Max Scherzer. And we just heard before we came back on that Paxton Schultz is starting the game today. We didn't really know if it would be Eric Lauer or Paxton Schultz. Obviously, this goes probably speaks to lineup construction for the Twins as well. Eric Lauer's pitched more, right?
Yes.
I think he had 42 pitches or something like that his last time out. What do you make, I guess, of the decision here of starting Schultz? I think we're probably still going to see Lauer today, but where do you stand on that?
Yeah, I got to think Schultz is going to pitch in I don't want to call it a traditional opener role because openers have not been around
right.
for that long, but he will pitch in that open role. I got to think if you're getting an inning and a third, an inning and two thirds out of Schultz before you turn it over to Lauer, you feel pretty good about that. Schneider actually said pregame yesterday when he was asked about it by Hazel,
yep.
he was saying that Lauer was tabbed for about 60 to 65 pitches, depending on what happened in the series finale against the Phillies. And then I think none of the guys who he had given kind of like ifs and ands about
yeah.
pitched yesterday anyways. So I think it actually worked out really well for the Blue Jays. So I think you'll probably see after Schultz, Lauer in that bulk role. I got to think Braden Fisher will pitch at some point tonight as well.
Yeah, Blue Jays should be in a good place bullpen-wise. We'll talk a bit more about that with Mitch Bannon of The Athletic,
yeah.
who's joining us in the second hour, because right now we're talking to Gord Ashe, Brewers VP of Baseball Projects, Canadian Baseball Hall of Famer, class of 2019. Gord, thanks for joining us. How are you doing today?
Doing very well, thank you.
Gord, we want to start by talking to you about the Canadian Baseball Hall of Fame, the weekend in St. Mary's. Obviously, you know, you were inducted a few years ago, but can you paint sort of a picture, sight, sounds of what it's like to be at Hall of Fame weekend in St. Mary's, Ontario?
Well, it's a tremendous gathering. It started last night with a function here in Toronto with this year's inductees. A lot of the fans come by. They have a great time. But, of course, the highlight of the weekend is Saturday's induction, and there'll be a good representation of former inductees and then, of course, all of this year's inductees. And it's really a great site of history. That's what intrigues me about it, is I enjoy the history of the game. There's a lot of it there. They're gathering more and more as the Hall of Fame grows over time. You know, this started out as a small venture that's grown into a much larger venture, and they have a permanent site now. They've got fields there where amateur baseball is played. So it's a real hive of baseball activity, and the day itself is a great opportunity for fans to get up close with some of their baseball heroes through the years.
Gord, you know, as someone from Toronto, I'm curious how you view the evolution of Canadian baseball over the years. I remember chatting with Mississauga's Josh Naylor when he won the Tip O'Neill Award last year, and they gave him the trophy when the Guardians came to the Rogers Centre, and he named guys like Joey Votto as his inspirations as Canadian ball players, a former Tip O'Neill Award winner himself. It feels like we're seeing more Canadians achieve more success in all sports. And I think when it happens in sports that are not hockey in this country, we're pleasantly surprised. But I think it's time maybe we say we're not pleasantly surprised because of the success Canadians are having in sports. I mean, you look at the NBA Finals, you got four Canadians between these two teams, which is really cool. And in baseball as well, I think you're starting to see more players come up through the ranks and be the Joey Vottos to a new generation of Josh Naylors. But I got to say, I think is really cool, and not something that even when I was younger that I necessarily thought would be as prolific as it is now.
Well, I think there's a lot of reasons for that. And I first think you have to start with the Expos when they came to Canada,
sure.
and brought the game to a nationwide audience. That planted the seed, and then, of course, grew much stronger with the Blue Jays in 77. And I think the big part of it is that the facilities became a whole lot better. There's a lot more indoor facilities now. Of course, with our weather, we need that for the winter time. I think the coaching, quality of coaching, and I know during my time with the Blue Jays, we ran a number of coaching clinics and tried to ensure that the coaching improved, which in turn made the players better. We created an amateur baseball department, and that was their sole focus, is to try and grow and improve the game at the grassroots level. And then I really think, even though numbers would probably, data would show that actual overall numbers might be down a little bit, I think the quality of player is much better than it used to be because of the coaching, because of the practice facilities, and because of the opportunities. And there's no question that role models whether it be Joey Votto or whoever. And he's clearly a great one. He had great love for the country and came home in the winter and would be part of the local baseball community. So I think all of those factors play a role in that, and it continues to get better all the time. And you're seeing players from right across the country. And at one time, it was particularly just British Columbia because of their ability to get more time outside in the winter, and then of course here in Ontario. But you're getting players from Quebec, you're getting players from Nova Scotia, you're getting players from right across the country. It's a much better situation now than it was. And you can't underplay the role of Baseball Canada either. But Greg Hamilton, who is one of this year's inductees, the role he's played in improving the situation, the players are exposed to a lot better competition than they used to be, and that helps too.
Gord, I wonder also, I know that, you know, Jose Bautista is not Canadian, but he has become sort of a reference point for baseball in this country. We all remember the bat flip. There are murals in this city. The kids have it, and adults now have it, you know, posters on their walls and things of the sort. When you have such an iconic moment, such an iconic presence, how cool is it for you to see someone like that inducted into the Canadian Baseball Hall of Fame as well?
Well, it's great, and you're right. I mean, he's not Canadian, but he spends a lot of time here, and I know he loves his time here, and that's one of the great things about the Blue Jay players from the past, whether it be Tony Fernandez or George Bell or Carlos Delgado, any of those types of players, all love their time here, and they cherish that opportunity and connected with the Canadian fans, and proud to be part of the Baseball Hall of Fame, Canadian Baseball Hall of Fame. So it's you're right. I mean, it's one of the most iconic moments for me, probably number two to Joe Carter's iconic moment. But it was a great thrill watching that game, and I know that it'll be fun for everybody tomorrow when Jose is inducted.
Just one more on the Canadian Baseball Hall of Fame, and then we can move on to maybe your impressions of the Blue Jays, your time with the Blue Jays as well. But I wanted to ask, how do you remember, I guess, your induction into the hall, from getting the call to making your speech? Is there anything that, you know, a few years removed from it stands out to you from that whole thing?
Well, I was very fortunate to be part of a great group. Rob Thompson, manager of the Phillies, was an inductee that year. Ryan Dempster, of course, another Canadian icon, and Jason Bay. We're all part of that group. I took a lot of ribbing because my speech was too long, which when I think back on it, I was afraid it was going to be too short. And obviously that wasn't the case. So, but it was a great day, great highlight of my time involved in baseball. I didn't think I would have that opportunity, and to get the call from Scott Crawford that February morning of 2019 is a very fond memory for me.
So, Gord, you mentioned your time as Toronto Blue Jays GM. I mean, you're the guy who drafted Roy Halladay, Vernon Wells, Alex Rios, just to name a few. I mean, I am curious, now you're still obviously involved in front offices with the Brewers, but how do you think drafting has changed, right? I mean, look, what's different about it now, about the process now, versus back in the late 90s, early 2000s? Like, it is, I know data and the sheer amount of data available is has changed basically all sports, not just baseball. But I am curious, now that you have both vantage points, how you see the art, perhaps, of drafting.
Yeah, it's clearly changed, like the rest of the game and like most sports. It's very data-driven, and the ability to collect data now is much easier than it was. And the analysts know what they're looking for, and the scouts obviously still go out and prepare their reports. But they also collect a lot of data, which goes into the system. There's a lot of more science to the decision process. Decision sciences are very prominent in the role in drafting. The Brewers, who I currently work for, have been very successful with their drafts and adding a lot of prospects. But in addition, I think you have to marry that with what scouts do, which is, in a lot of cases, know the players. The data can tell you a lot, but it can't tell you everything. What kind of individual is he? Is he coachable? Is he team-oriented? Is he somebody that's going to accept failure because it's a big part of the game? So that's where scouts come into play, and I think those clubs that blend both of those aspects are clubs that do much better. And it's changed dramatically in that the draft used to be in early June, now it's in mid-July. So it's, again, a longer look at players. That used to be one of the major complaints, especially for scouts in cold weather areas where you couldn't see the players very much before you had to draft them. So that's changed dramatically now. And I think the whole evolution of travel baseball and the specialty teams that have been formed, creating players that are easier to see because they're all together in one place.
You know, we're talking about your time as GM as well, and I mean, you were also in a pretty unique position as GM of the team here in Toronto in 1994-1995, because baseball was coming out of the strike that year that saw the cancellation of the World Series. I mean, I'm just curious from your perspective, now that you can look back on it, Gord, what that was like. I mean, again, you've been in MLB front offices for a really long time. I mean, can you now look back on that with a different eye?
No, it was painful then. It's painful to
think about.
And, you know, clearly for fans in this country, the Expos, of course, were leading. We're a great team that year, and to be denied the opportunity to progress in the postseason is something that's not a pleasant memory at all. For our club, we won in 92, 93, 94. I think there was some fatigue had set in, and we weren't playing all that well. So in some ways, it was a bit of a relief. But I don't think looking back on it, and it's so long ago now, 30 years ago or more, you think that it wasn't going to last as long as it did. And I think that's probably what took everybody by surprise. So, and then I don't think we started the next spring training, the 95 spring training, until into April. So it was a long winter, and not something that anybody relished in ever happening again.
Yeah, let's hope it doesn't. It doesn't happen again, especially in that form, the way that it happened there. Cancellation of the World Series is never something that will make anyone happy. But fast forwarding to present day, World Series is still on schedule here, Gord. And I am wondering, obviously, your work with the Brewers keeps you busy, but do you still find time to sort of check in on the Blue Jays and how they're doing? And if so, what are your impressions from a little bit afar, I guess, at this point?
Yeah, I'm fortunate. I have two teams. I spent 25 years with the Blue Jays, so it's still an integral part of my history in the game. And it's 24 now, I guess, with the Brewers. So, both teams have been successful postseason. Brewers here lately have been successful. The teams are built completely differently. The Brewers have some payroll restrictions, and we have to, I guess I call ourselves, we're almost like the Tampa Bay of the National League. We have to do things differently. But it worked for us. Our pitching is very good. It's what keeps the club competitive, and we develop spend a lot of time on that aspect. The Blue Jays, I enjoy watching the Blue Jays. I get to a few games a year, and I'll be looking forward to the end of August when the Brewers and the Blue Jays match up here in Toronto. That'll be a good weekend. Every club goes through phases, and I think the Blue Jays look to me like they're clearly on the upswing at the moment. Their offensive struggles seem to have rectified a little bit, and hopefully they can continue that. It can be a fun team to watch. They've got some great personalities on that team, and I think better days ahead over the summer months.
Yeah, safe to say that when the Blue Jays win, we all win. Gord, we really appreciate you joining. We hope you have the best time in St. Mary's this weekend. We're glad that you're already having a good time, even in Toronto. Thank you for joining us, and good luck with everything.
My pleasure. Thank you.
There he goes. Gord Ash of the Milwaukee Brewers, former Blue Jays front office man, Canadian Baseball Hall of Famer. What a career. What a career for Gord Ash, and obviously still going, but kind of nice, right, Joe, to sort of reminisce a bit about old times and think about how things have changed. I thought that was a very interesting question about how drafting has changed and how, I guess, data, really, and analytics have played a part in it. Where did that come from for you?
Yeah, because, you know, I've had this conversation multiple times, but with our mutual friend, Chris LaRue, right? And Chris, of course, the color man on the Blue Jays radio broadcast, the Canadian pitcher himself, of course. And Chris was drafted, I think, in like the mid-2000s, right? And I remember having a conversation with him a couple of weeks ago, and we talked about this last year too, during many rain delays, where Chris and I would discuss like how pitching itself has changed, how like when he was coming up, if a guy could throw like 94, 95 miles an hour, you're like, wow, that's amazing. That guy is going in the first round for sure. And I mean, drafting in any sport is an inexact science, but even in baseball in particular, when there's like a million rounds and it goes on forever. And also I think in a sport where prospects are not necessarily called up right away, right? Like if you get drafted in the first round in the NBA, like you're a top five pick in the NBA, you're playing 25 plus minutes a game every night, starting game one that year, right? if you're a top three pick in the NFL and you're a quarterback or a defensive lineman or a receiver, you're playing day one more than likely, right? But that's not really the case in, I would say, hockey and certainly in baseball. So I think having the conversation with Chris, and now how it's like every young guy coming out of prep school or college in the NCAA or internationally, he has to throw 99 to 101 just to be noticed by scouts these days. So I just thought it was interesting. I mean, as someone who's had some pretty big hits when it comes to Halladay, right, and Wells and Rios, I mean, I think I was just curious to see how things have changed for him. He's not wrong about the Brewers, too. I mean, the Brewers have been an absolute pitching factory in the last couple of years. I mean, Corbin Burnes, Freddie Peralta, I know Brandon Woodruff's still making his way back from injury, but all three of those guys and more have all been really good for the Brewers. So it's pretty remarkable. And his description, Gord, of calling the Brewers like the Tampa Bay Rays of the NL, I think is also pretty accurate, given that, you know, we say the Rays can like sprinkle the pixie dust on someone and make them an all-star. So it's pretty impressive what Gord has seen over like a career that spans starting in the 70s to now, essentially.
Yeah. Zero analytics to present day.
Yeah.
You kind of have to adapt as you go in order to stay relevant and still make good decisions and things of the sort without losing the feel for it, right? Which I think is a big thing. So that is always a fascinating conversation. We get to talk to these guys who have been around for a little bit longer. We're going to take a quick break show. Mm-hmm. And when we come back, we're going to talk to Mitch Bannon, Blue Jays beat reporter, for The Athletic. We're certainly going to talk about Paxton Schultz getting the start today. We're going to talk some more about this Philly series and the big win for the Blue Jays. He also put together a Blue Jays quarter century team. Mm-hmm. I'm very excited to ask him about that.
I love all-timers. They're so much fun.
That is all when we come back with Jays Talk Plus. Julia Kreutz, Sho Ali filling in for Blake Murphy. We'll be right back.
Teeing up the biggest games of the night, it's the Fan Pregame with Ailish Forfar and Justin Cuthbert.
Weekdays at 6 p.m. on Sportsnet, Sportsnet 590 The Fan, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Jays Talk Plus. I'm Julia Kreutz. Alongside me today is Sho Ali filling in for Blake Murphy. The Blue Jays take 2 out of 3 against the Phillies. A good way to sort of go into a lengthy road trip here. 3 against the Twins, Sho, coming up tonight. It is Paxton Schultz going against Bailey Ober. We are going to talk to Mitch Bannon of The Athletic very soon here, but Paxton Schultz over Eric Lauer, that's something to look out for. We'll see how far he goes into this game. He threw 30 pitches his last time out.
Schultz
did, right. Yes. Lauer was 42, something like that. So we'll see if Schultz here is used more as an opener, and if we see Lauer take the bulk of it. Eric Lauer has succeeded in pretty much anything the Blue Jays have asked of him. Yeah, you know, obviously you would rather have somewhat of a set fifth starter there. The Blue Jays will take whatever they can get at this point. Well-rested bullpen. We should be in a good spot. We're going to talk to Mitch Bannon now, who joins us. Mitch Bannon from The Athletic. Mitch, nice to see you again. Nice to see you're doing well after all of the festivities yesterday. It was nice seeing you also outside of a work environment. How are you doing after Keegan's book signing there?
It was good. Yeah, outside of the work environment.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah, I guess
25
not.
Feet from the normal work environment, I guess. But it was it was good.
Yeah, you could literally see the ballpark.
Keegan have a big day.
And it was nice to just, you know, I guess we're always talking baseball. It was just like in a slightly different location because, yeah, we were in the outfield, right? You could literally see the press box from Sportsnet Grill there. Nevertheless, I'd say it was a cool change of scenery for us. Although there's a lot of good stuff to talk about with this team right now, 2 out of 3 against the Phillies, including a big win yesterday. Just as a general question here, because of the way that the season started, and then you kind of see the offensive renaissance, especially against the A's, the Philly series starts, we see a couple of games where the Blue Jays are not scoring a ton of runs, and then another breakout. Is it still too soon to sort of understand exactly who this team is when it comes to offense here?
Part of me says yes. Like, it's, they've still done it, as you kind of outlined there, in such weird ways where it's like the ebbs and flows, and they're like not really scoring. They're probably averaging like 4.5 runs a game, but they're never scoring 4 or 5 runs a game. It's the polars of the two outcomes there, which they're getting the most. But when you add it all up, it's been a pretty good offense this year. And I think one of the reasons that in my mind I'm starting to kind of come around on the offense is, yeah, they're getting the contributions from everyone, like the Miles Straws of the world, the Nathan Lucases of the world. And maybe one or two of those breakouts falls off a little. But there's kind of other guys you would expect to pick up the slack if the slack ever comes. Like, the team hasn't gotten much from Anthony Santander. Like, we know there's another level in Vlad. Like, there's ways for like the great stories to fall off a little and this offense to still retain like a pretty good clip for the rest of the season.
Yeah, I would say, Mitch, it's hard not to feel optimistic about the team, because I was saying this to Jules earlier, but when you sweep any, first of all, when you sweep any team, it's just hard to sweep teams, right? So when you take a 3-game sweep, in this case, a 4-game sweep against the A's, you think to yourself, all right, like, you know what, that's a pretty good place to start. It's you enjoy it, but you want to see them have these kinds of results replicated against teams like the Phillies and certainly like the Twins starting later tonight. But then they go and do it, right? And I know the first inning and a bit of the game against the Phillies was not ideal from a pitching perspective, but I mean, and I know this is not how you view games. I understand this, but after Bowden Francis left the game, the Blue Jays effectively like won that game essentially when it comes to runs scored. So I'm with you in that the pitching has been really good, especially from the starting rotation, and Eric Lauer in that game against the Phillies pitched well, and he's going to pitch tonight. But I think I find it hard not to be optimistic about the team when they take 2 of 3 against, and I know the Phillies are scuffling, but one of the better teams in the NL, a team that a lot of people picked to represent the NL in the World Series.
Yeah, for sure. I think as much as 4 straight wins against the A's was huge for this team to kind of vault themselves and give themselves space between 500 and where their record is, then following it up with a series win against anyone would have been big, because this is a team that's kind of rattled off sweeps, rattled off good series, and then immediately got swept or put up a stinker afterwards. This week was different. They got the 4-game sweeps, the first and maybe only 4-game sweep they'll get all year. Those are really hard to do. They won a series after that, despite a tough first inning. And they won it against, as you mentioned, a really good Phillies squad. Like, I know they had a bunch of guys on that side that were sick this week. I know Jesus Luzardo has not been the guy he was for the first couple months. But winning a series against that Phillies lineup is still very hard to do. And they did it and took, what, a 6-1 homestand. There's no reason to complain about a 6-1 homestand.
Mitch, you had a tweet recently that was very interesting, in which you sort of compared, you did a side-by-side comparison, let's put it like that, between May of last year and May of this year, if I'm not mistaken. And there were some, you know, more advanced stats. There were some more basic stats. What can you learn from an exercise like that? And for you specifically, what did that tell you when you sort of looked at the numbers side by side like that?
Yeah, I think it was a reminder that kind of around this point last year, like the 2024 Jays weren't like a complete lost cause yet. Like, they were still kind of a decent team. So a lot of like the metrics, the pitching metrics, the rotation metrics look pretty similar to this squad. There's been one big difference between the 2024 version and 2025. Yeah, you would think it would be the offense, and it has a little bit, but really it's the bullpen. That was the one glaring jump that this team has made compared to last year. I think, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but they went from like the 23rd or 4th ranked bullpen at this time last year to a top 10 unit. And not only are they top 10 in terms of bullpen ERA, but I truly believe with like the guys they have in this bullpen, it is a top 10 unit. Like Jeff Hoffman has had kind of his bad appearances objectively. Jimmy Garcia is on the IL, but like other guys have stepped up. Hoffman, I think, is going to be a really good closer for this team. Jimmy's going to come back and be really good. Like they just have guys that should be pitching in a really good bullpen. And you definitely couldn't really say that about last year's team.
Yeah, I've been really impressed by, I mean, Brendan Little has pitched in leverage. He's been really good. Mason Fluharty has pitched in higher leverage situations. He's been very impressive, I thought, after a couple of rough outings to start the season. I mean, Chad Green, I think some of the peripherals with Green show that maybe he is declining just a little bit, Mitch. But still, I mean, he's impressed in the last couple of outings he's had. Yariel Rodriguez, we haven't seen pitch in a couple of days. I mean, he's been really good. I mean, he's been one of the best relievers in the American League in since the beginning of May, essentially. So I'm with you. The bullpen has looked great. I mean, Eric Lauer, I guess, like, technically is a member of the bullpen,
yeah,
but he's being treated as a starter at this point. I want to ask you, Mitch, what do you think Lauer has to do in order to, I don't know if lockdown is the right word, but in order to garner, pitch more as a, and I'm using air quotes here, like as a starter, essentially, right? Because we know he's going to pitch in a bulk role tonight. Schultz is getting the start. But with the recent failings, unfortunately, of Bowden Francis, like, I wonder what that looks like for the fifth spot. I think they expect the team, Max Scherzer, to come back like in the not too distant future. So maybe that ends up being the case. But I wonder what Lauer has to do to gain some kind of semi-permanent starting role.
Yeah, I think for Lauer, one of like the biggest curses for him is how like level-headed and versatile he's been for this team. Like if he was bad as a reliever but good as a starter, the Jays would be straight using him as a starter. His issue is he's been good in every single role, which is almost forcing or allowing Schneider to just use him in a bunch of these roles. Like we saw him pitch, I think it was like 40 or 50 pitches a couple days ago. He's probably going to do the same again tonight. Like I agree, just off performance and like looking at a rotation, building out the best five guys, Lauer deserves that fifth spot right now, objectively, maybe even the fourth spot, given how other things have gone. But I think his versatility has kind of been his curse so far. And with the hope of Scherzer coming back, I kind of suspect the Jays want to keep that versatility to keep him on the big league roster, even when Scherzer is in town. Like the other day, John Schneider compared him to Ryan Yarbrough, which I know for for some real locked in Blue Jays fans might be a sore spot given how things happened at the beginning of the year and how he's pitched for the Yankees. But I think it's a great comp, like a guy who can go two innings, can face lefties, or he can go five or six and face everyone in a lineup. Like he's truly the utility knife for this team right now. And it has prevented him from taking like a lockdown rotation spot and running with it.
I think Sho can relate to the versatility sometimes being a curse here. This man is good at everything. And we got a text on the text line here. And by the way, 590-590, leave your name and location. Standard message and data rates may apply. But this is an interesting one because it kind of speaks to the bullpen as well, at least for my answer. So there's no name on the text, but it says, who has been the most surprising player for the Blue Jays so far, good or bad, who stands out? And I say that it kind of relates to the bullpen because my answer is Yariel Rodriguez. I think he's been super, super impressive. Where do you stand, Mitch? Do you have a standout guy here?
Yeah, part of me wants to go Alejandro Kirk just because I kind of thought we knew what he was offensively after the past couple of years, like a slightly below average hitter, just like a stable option. But there's another half of my brain that has to go Brendan Little. Like, I'll go back to the bullpen if we're going to bullpen it up today. Like, the guy has been maybe the best left-handed reliever in baseball right now. He has the best pitch in baseball right now in his curveball. Like, who saw that coming? Like, I thought left-handed relief was going to be like the biggest issue for this team entering this season. And Mason Fluharty has been a great number two option in the pen there. Eric Lauer, another lefty reliever technically right now, has been great. And Brendan Little is atop all of the options in all of baseball. I think there's a very real chance he's the guy representing the Blue Jays at the All-Star game this year. And I certainly didn't have that on my radar on opening day.
Is it fair to say that Braden Fisher could also be a surprise. I mean, he's not pitched a lot, I understand. And I know the last outing for him did not go as planned, obviously. But, I mean, barring that maybe one hiccup, I've actually been... Look, I've been impressed enough to the point where I'd be willing to watch him pitch, maybe not in leverage again, certainly, Mitch, but pitch again in larger moments because guys like Sandlin and Burr and certainly Jimmy Garcia have not yet returned. When they do return, I got to think Fisher will be one of those guys that gets sent back down. But still, I mean, at least for now, you probably will see him pitch in, again, not high leverage, but maybe like medium leverage moments, I might imagine.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. He's been very impressive. Like, his only hiccup is the time they asked him to start a game against a team that had just lost a bunch of games in a row and kind of jumped at the opportunity of some missed pitches by Fisher. Like, every time he's come in that mid-leverage, he's been great. The leverage, he's been really great. I think you mentioned Chad Green earlier and about how some of the advanced metrics didn't really love him this year. He has been pretty solid lately, but if he kind of takes a step back or has a rough patch or goes on the IL, I think Fisher's a perfectly placed to take that role. That sixth, seventh, maybe you're losing by one run, maybe it's a tie game. They have very similar dispositions. They're both just pretty chill guys who show up and do their business and don't really show a lot of the emotion of wins or losses. So I think he's kind of perfectly placed to take the mantle of Chad if Chad needs a blow at any point.
Mitch, let's stick with pitching, but we haven't spoken about Chris Bassitt yet at length. Huge bounce back for him. He was so hard on himself after his previous start, saying, you know, using words like terrible and things like that. Well, this time he can't really be that hard on himself. He pitched well with seven innings of one run ball. He spoke about moving from the third base side of the rubber to the first base side of the rubber. What did you see from him? What were the strides? And what can something like just changing your positioning on the mound do for a pitcher to get out of a funk?
Yeah, that's kind of been like an ongoing battle for Chris Bassitt for the last like 3 years. He has this, for a guy who has so many pitches, he goes through these stretches where like either lefties are killing him and he can't figure out how to get lefties, or he moves too far the other direction across the mound and now righties are getting him too much and he's not struggling against the lefties anymore. He's kind of been searching for that sweet spot the entire season, going back to last season. Yesterday, definitely had the sweet spot. And I think the thing for Bassitt, and you kind of alluded to it there, is he holds himself to such an insanely high standard. Like, he has been one of baseball's most reliable starters over the last couple of years. And if you talk to him, you would think he was on this roller coaster of the greatest starts ever and the worst starts ever, and he just wants to get back to the good ones. But he has been a reliable guy, and he's got to kind of balance the tinkering and trying to get even better with just like taking the good starts, taking the quality starts, and providing this team the innings that he kind of has since he got here. I know he's not going to stop tinkering because he holds himself to that high standard, but I think the Blue Jays will be certainly happy with just six innings, two or three earned runs, every start from Chris Bassitt.
Yeah, Bassitt was great. I mean, he, in his last couple of starts prior to yesterday, he had kind of struggled. I mean, I know the start at Steinbrenner Field was a hot one. And not that that's necessarily an excuse, but he didn't particularly pitch well. And then the following game, he kind of thought there'd be a bounce back, also did not pitch particularly great. And it's interesting. I mean, yesterday he went sinker cutter curve in terms of his most used pitches, 40% sinker, 26% cutter, 20% curve. And I thought the cutter in those two starts, when it's not cutting, essentially, you're just throwing an 88, 89 mile an hour
fastball
down the middle that doesn't have movement, and batters were just teeing off on it. So for him to get back the movement on that pitch, I thought looked really great. Well done by Bassitt. I think just in a general sense too, guys, I mean, when you look at how Gausman has looked recently in his last maybe three starts at this point, Berríos had a phenomenal start in the second game of this series against the Phillies. I mean, that might be one of his more impressive starts, period, as a Blue Jay, considering how many lefty hitters were loaded in this lineup from the Philly side of things. I mean, I think the starting rotation, especially with those three, there were some question marks, right, Mitch? Like, not that long ago, there were question marks as to, you know, is age starting to be a factor here? Is the splitter not splitting for Gausman? Can Berríos, Marshall, Corral, the sinker and the slurve effectively at the same time? I think the answer to all those questions is yes now, right? I mean, they've been able to put it together so effectively. I think some of the questions about the starting rotation feel a little less daunting when you look forward, even between now and the All-Star break, but now and the rest of the season.
Yeah, completely. I'll admit that, like, There's a part of me that's a stats guy. Like, you look at Jose Berríos, you look at Chris Bassett, and you see their high expected ERAs, the projected decline at their age, and you're like, oh, the rotation for the Blue Jays, like, could be a problem this year. There was a part of me that thought that coming into the season. But I think those big three have kind of reminded me of, like, the soft science of baseball. Just, like, the people, these are people who go out and pitch, and those three guys are, like, the definition of workhorses. Like, they're going to give you six innings on their bad starts. They're going to have bad stuff one day and still figure out how to only let up two runs. Like, that's a trio that very truly defies kind of, like, common aging curves, common, like, perceptions of what a guy should be when he doesn't have good stuff, like, what you need to get people out in 2025. And, like, having three guys like that kind of collectively defying what you would think coming into a season like this and overcoming blips and continuing to adjust at their age is really stabilized what could have been, like, a big mess in the rotation for them after they lost Scherzer. So I expect those guys to continue to be workhorses, and we'll see what happens when they get close to the end of the season, if the workloads catch up to them. But those are the three guys that, if they're going to make the postseason, are going to get them there.
Yeah, you were not alone, Mitch, in thinking that the rotation might be a problem. Sho and I did a bold predictions edition something before the season started during spring training. And one of Ben Nicholson-Smith's predictions was that the offense would be fine and the disappointment would come from the pitching side. And so that is something that, if you are looking at advanced metrics, if you're looking at expected ERA and things of the sort, yeah, you're probably reaching that conclusion. But it is cool to kind of see these guys defy a little bit of what the projections say. That said, Mitch, now we're in a bit of a different pickle here, which is Bowden Francis can't seem to figure it out. Nothing is really working right now, seemingly. The fastball is in a weird place. The breaking balls are very inconsistent. The splitter is not breaking at all, pretty much. And there might be a conversation to be had about that rotation spot as well. And I'm wondering what that does for the rotation as a whole, but especially for the big three, because, again, there's a ton of pressure on these guys, right?
Yeah. Whether or not Bowden Francis kind of locks back in or Max Scherzer comes back, I think the pressure is going to remain on the top three of that rotation to provide the innings that you're just probably not going to get from Francis and Scherzer if they do stabilize in the fourth and fifth spots. So that pressure is not going anywhere, for sure. You're right. But on Francis, yeah, it is quite confusing to try to figure out how he gets back to what he looked like last year. Like, we saw one of the highest highs in all of baseball in his run last season. And he's kind of doing a lot of the same stuff this year, throwing the same pitches, trying to put them in the same spots. And it's resulted in one of the lowest lows in the rotation. And trying to grapple with that is difficult for him. It's difficult for the team. In talking about and after his last start, like, he felt like he was missing his spots by a baseball. And against a good Phillies lineup, yeah, if you miss your spots by that much, you're going to get punished. I also think the Jays' game plan in the opener against the Phillies was to pitch away. And we saw them take advantage of those pitches away and just hammer them to the opposite field and hammered Francis. And he didn't really have the opportunity to make an adjustment and start coming back inside. After the start, he told me he knows he's got to start pitching inside more. And I know people outside of the org have talked about that as well. Francis knows that. He hears that. And I expect he will do that in his next start. He just didn't really have the opportunity to make the adjustment when you're out after 1.2 and gave up, I think it was 7 or 8 runs. Like, I get that you got to make a move there. So we'll see how he adapts next start. We saw the Jays kind of implement that with Berríos and Bassett in the two starts after against the Phillies, and it worked really effectively. But it's on Bowden to not miss his spots by a ball and implement those adjustments going forward. Like, I don't think they're going to go away from him because they don't really have any obvious options to backfill that spot right now. Spencer Turnbull is going to make a really big start for the Bisons today, and we'll see if he becomes an option either for some length or in the rotation going forward. But I expect we see at least a few more starts of Bowden before they even discuss what to do next.
Yeah, I'm really curious to see what Turnbull looks like, because I think the last time out, he got through like 1 2/3. It was 50-something pitches, 3 walks, 2 earned runs, not in a particularly large span of gameplay. So I'm curious to see what it looks like for him tonight. Jules, before we let Mitch go,
yep.
Do I have time
Absolutely
to ask him about the all quarter century team. We have time for this?
Absolutely we do. we do have 5 minutes. I want to say that must have been a really tough exercise, right?
Yeah.
I wonder, first of all, how many angry messages you got. And now you're going to get some angry comments from this guy right here.
I don't know if I say angry. Like, this seems like a strong way to characterize it. But
get ready, Mitch.
I did like the list, Mitch. I will say I saw The Athletic was doing the all quarter century list for all of baseball, like for all of Major League Baseball. I believe the only Blue Jay who got on there was Roy Halladay, which is pretty cool. And I know some people quibbled with that, not in Toronto certainly, but from a larger perspective. I don't, people are saying, oh, it should be Pedro Martinez, but I think most of Pedro's best time came just prior to that, if you're comparing it to the height of Roy Halladay. So no quibbles from me. I'm biased. I also really like Doc, so why am I gonna argue with that? No. But I do want to get to your list. So for those who haven't seen it, you can find it on The Athletic, but a lot of names you're familiar with, I think, right? Russell Martin is the catcher, Marcus Semien, second base, Carlos Delgado, my favorite player of all time, at first base, Bo Donaldson, Shannon Stewart, Vernon Wells, Jose Bautista, Edwin, all in the filling out the position players. I think the one that came to mind the most for me, Mitch, was the Semien pick. Because I think if you had asked me, just on the top of your head, if you had said, who is the best Blue Jays second baseman between 2000 and 2025, I think without thinking about it, I would have said Aaron Hill. But I'm not going to quibble with the height of what Marcus Semien achieved. But I think if you're going for longevity, it's Hill for me. But I think that's probably one of the tougher choices, I would say, in this whole exercise.
Yeah, for sure. That in left field, like Shannon Stewart versus Lourdes versus Teoscar Hernandez play left field well enough or for long enough to justify a pick there. That was a tough one. But yeah, second base, I didn't get too many hate comments because I've kind of premeditated where people were going to push back. And, you know, you throw in the, oh, if you're a longevity guy, I'm sure you're going Aaron Hill here, line in. And now what are people going to say? Are they're going to be disgusted with me already recognizing what they're going to be disgusted with? But Hill versus Semien was tough. Like, it was kind of like the good for a long time versus like one of the best second base seasons we've ever seen for one year was like a tough one for me. If Semien wasn't like historically good in that year, I think it's the most home runs by an American League second baseman ever, he wouldn't have been the pick. And if Hill had like a little bit of a higher high in any of his years with the Jays, he would have been the pick. It came down to just the historic nature of Semien's season, albeit only one season, was what pushed him over Hill for me.
Was that the toughest one for you? I'm assuming the starting rotation is also a tough one to sort of navigate. But tell me, I guess, what the hardest parts were about doing this.
Yeah, the rotation after Halladay was so hard.
That's tough.
It's like there was nine guys who were kind of like all kind of the same with like two or three really good years. Some guys had some more length. The guys who had like a lot of time with the Jays didn't have like the highest highs. It was kind of a mess after Doc. I think I initially had Marcus Stroman in my top five in the rotation, and then I had to bump him, sorry, Marcus, for Jay Happ, because I kind of, for the back four spots in the rotation, I decided I was going to prioritize kind of like the longevity of success with the Blue Jays. And you look at Happ's couple tenures in Toronto, and like he was quietly really good for this team for a long time, won 20 games. I know people don't care about that, but he won 20 games. He had like very high Cy Young votes one year. His career with the Jays was remarkably similar to Stroman's. I just thought like the highs were a little bit higher, especially in the regular season. And he struck out a lot of batters for Toronto. I think it was the second most this century of any Blue Jays pitcher has been Jay Happ.
Yeah, I think Stroman might have been the guy. Stroman or maybe like Ricky Romero, maybe. I think it might have been the two guys that would have picked over Happ. But yeah, I mean, it's hard to quibble with it when you're talking about strikeouts, right? I think too, what kind of dings Stroman to a certain extent is that he was never a huge strikeouts guy, right? Like, that's also a thing. Like, I think when you look at lists of strikeouts for Stroman, he's like never going to be super high on any of those lists because his game is he gets the ball on the ground. Less so this year, right? Obviously, right? But for his time with the Blue Jays, that was like a hallmark of his ability. So I do understand. Like, if strikeouts is how you view the metric, I'm with you on Happ. The closer aspect of it too, I thought was really fascinating. I mean, you picked Jordan Romano, and I mean, Jordan Romano is, if you look at all-time, if you look at in two ways, if you look at all-time Blue Jays closers, strikeouts, and saves certainly as well, and if you look at Canadian-born closers, I think he's pretty high on both lists, so it's hard to go elsewhere, but it's pretty funny. I hadn't actually realized how high BJ Ryan and like Casey Jansen were on some of these lists until I was like, who else could you really pick outside of Jordan Romano? But he kind of is the best guy to pick when it comes to saves, I think, in the from 2000 to 2025.
Yeah, I was almost surprised how easy that pick was. Like, it's, I think we forget how,
I know,
before Romano and like before, like, or after kind of like the peak years before 2000, like, this team didn't have like a closer that just locked games down for like 4 or 5 years in a row. Like, it was kind of, they had moments from guys for sure, a couple year runs from guys, but like the 10 years of closers, I think maybe it's a baseball-wide thing where closers just are kind of fleeting these days, but the Blue Jays definitely felt that for a long time. And it was Romano, albeit had a really rough last year with Toronto, the years that preceded it were put him miles ahead, I think, of any other option.
Now he's with the Phillies. Jeff Hoffman is here. The Blue Jays are going to try to extend this run of good play starting tonight against the Phillies. And you can go check out the quarter-century story from Mitch on The Athletic, a lot of other great content. You've been killing it since you joined The Athletic there. Mitch, thank you so much for doing this. We hope you enjoy your weekend, and we hope to talk to you again soon.
Yeah, thanks, guys. Thanks for having me. Have a good weekend.
There he goes. That's Mitch Bannon from The Athletic. Some good stuff. I'm glad we kept it civil.
How dare you not pick Aaron Hill? How dare you?
Okay, we're gonna have to take a quick break here, but when we come back, we're going to talk to Brandon Warn of Locked On Twins podcast. He has a Access Twins Substack as well. We're going to break down this what to expect from this series against the Twins, how the Twins are doing. They had a great stretch earlier in the season. Things seem to have normalized now for them, but still a very difficult team to play against, especially on the road. That is all happening when we come back as Jays Talk Plus continues with Julia Kreutz and Sho Ali filling in for Blake Murphy.
Unrivaled insight, analysis, and opinions on all things Blue Jays. Blair and Barker. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus with Julia Kreutz and Sho Ali filling in for Blake Murphy. The Blue Jays starting a pretty big road trip tonight. First pitch goes in Minnesota at 8:10 Eastern. It's Paxton Schultz against Bailey Ober on the mound. And we're going to break down the Twins now, Sho, as Brandon Warn of Locked On Twins podcast, Access Twins Substack, joins us. Brandon, thank you for being here. How are you doing?
Hey, doing pretty good. Good morning. How are you guys doing?
Good morning. We're doing pretty well. It's almost not morning anymore. I get in a little bit out of rhythm here.
He's in Minneapolis, so he gets an extra hour, right? Yeah. So it's fine.
Yeah. The studio, too, you kind of forget that there is a world outside and the sun is shining and all of that. But good day for baseball for sure. Wanted to, start by asking you, Brandon, about just that tremendous stretch that the Twins had a bit earlier in the season, 13 straight wins. It seemed like everything was going according to plan for them after a slow start to the season too, right? So what did you sort of see in that stretch that maybe was the optimal situation for a team like the Twins?
Pitching, and more pitching. The offense has really kind of rode the wave all season long. And it's a very well-documented fact that if they score 4 runs, that's kind of their sweet spot. But the rotation was tremendous, although with Pablo Lopez down, that is going to be something to keep an eye on. Bullpen, exceptional. It's just, it came down to they started scoring some runs. And the funny thing was, they did that, and in the midst of it, lost Carlos Correa and Byron Buxton to one of the most problematic player collisions of Twins history, as both were concussed. So they managed with Cody Clemens riding a career best streak and a few other guys finding it at the right time to get right back in the thick of it in the AL Central, which is where I believe they'd be all along, but took a minute to get there.
I'm curious, Brandon, like, how much importance should either fan base, whether it's Jays or Twins, be placing on this series? Because, you know, on one hand, these teams probably going to be jockeying for position in the AL wildcard race for a good chunk of the season. On the other hand, I mean, it's the beginning of June, and there's still a lot of baseball left to be played. I mean, in the Blue Jays' case, they have exactly, including tonight, 100 games remaining. So still a lot of baseball. Having said that, of course, all teams want to win. So how much importance do you think any of us should be placing on a three-game set at the beginning of June?
Well, and I think what's funny is they're both about the same distance back in the division, but now the added wild cards in the last few years help both of their chances. So honestly, it's hard for me to really say that. What the Twins need is to really show, you know, the start by David Festa after Lopez went down would probably make a lot of fans be like, oh no, what are they going to do pitching-wise? So having some sort of calming effort from Bailey Ober in this first game, at least, would go a long way toward calming Twins fans down. As far as the Blue Jays, you know, it comes down to keeping up with the, you know, your buddies in the East. And the Rays, you know, we just saw the Rays. That minor league ballpark is really something, I tell you what. Again, I know why they're there. It's just still an incredible, incredible story. But, you know, at some point, you just got to kind of forget about the top and battle where you can. And I think right now, it's not like vital to win these games in the sense that you got to like wring your hands over it. But you don't want to lose sight of the fact that, you know, you want to take two out of three when you have the chance, split your four gamers. And the Twins just came off a 5-5 road trip that started not so great in Tampa Bay. So again, it all comes down to just, you know, not letting yourself get too far out in front of it and staying in the moment at the time.
Brandon, you mentioned Pablo Lopez going on the IL. He's expected, if I'm not mistaken, he's expected to miss anywhere between 8 weeks and 12 weeks, something like that. Seems like, you know, a considerable deal. And then you look at the rest of this rotation, there are some young guys like David Festa, even like Simeon Woods Richardson, a former Blue Jays prospect here. How much pressure, I guess, does losing a Pablo Lopez put in the rest of the rotation, and especially in these young guys, when it comes to length and you know, getting to where you want to go?
Well, and that's the biggest thing. Their bullpen has been great, but you can overwork them quite easily. We saw it with Cleveland last year and Stephen Vogt in his rookie season. You got to be careful to strike that balance. And Zebby Matthews, David Festa, and Simeon Woods Richardson, who still figures prominently in their future plans, I suspect, they've all been kind of that five and dive type pitcher. So I think the pressure will also lie on guys like Chris Paddock, who has pitched well of late, maybe doesn't have the strikeouts you'd want, but needs to show he can stave off any part of regression there. Bailey Ober has been uneven. Like, if you look at some of his numbers under the hood, he's still giving up a high OPS to righties and lefties. The whip is not particularly good. And Joe Ryan has been exceptional, but he's also coming off injury. And believe it or not, it's the same injury that Pablo has. So, there's immense pressure on a rotation that has been good, but, you know, there are definitely hills to still be climbed and get past to get to where they need to be here before Pablo gets back, which they're hoping he can throw in about a month and, you know, just kind of build back up to where he was before. But again, with Joe Ryan, he missed the rest of the season and had a full off season of, you know, ramp up. It's going to look different with Pablo if he comes back in season.
You mentioned, Brandon, the collision with Buxton and Correa. And Buxton returned from the IL not that long ago, right? Just about a week ago, I suppose. Right. And more or less got right back into the swing of things. I mean, 7 RBI in a 2-game span against the A's at the beginning of this past week. I mean, so he's the man, right? Like, he's the guy, middle of a $100 million deal. He's 31 years old, lots of baseball in front of him. He is a guy who has dealt with injury concerns. I know this collision with Correa was a concussion, and he's dealt with other issues like hip issues and so on. But I am just curious, you watch him a lot more closely than we do. How has he looked now that he is in his 30s and he's moving past some of these other injury concerns?
Phenomenal. The only thing he has no interest in is taking walks. And when you can run that fast, why would you ever walk, right? No, the defense has been great. Actually, the sprint speed is right where you'd want it. And the funny thing is, his manager was Paul Molitor, and I had Paul Molitor on my show a while back, and he told me that what he said to Byron was, listen, it's not impossible to be healthier in your 30s than your 20s. It's not likely. Not a lot of people do it. But look no further than my career. And that's a good point. Paul Molitor was healthier in his 30s than his 20s. That's how he became a Hall of Famer. He went through Toronto, went through Minnesota. Lots of common threads here. But we haven't had that level of, like, you know, waiting for the next shoe to drop or the next injury to come. He's hit the wall a couple times and been, knock on wood, mostly healthy when he's been playing out there. And it's just, I feel less concerned about him right now than I have at any point in his career. Now, maybe that says more about me than anybody else, but he's been wonderful this year, and the Twins can't go anywhere that they want to go without him.
I'm going to stick with sort of the injury topic more or less, and I know that there's a component to it, an injury component to this, but simple as this, what's up with Royce Lewis? Why can't he get it going here?
he's hitting the ball when he's hitting it harder of late. I honestly, like, this is a guy who is universally positive, very excited, very excitable. And he's even had some public comments where it's like, oh man, you know, if he's losing faith, that's a little bit worrisome. I don't know that they would send him down, but they did do kind of a soft reset here in the beginning of the A's series. And the hope is that will kind of allow him to just kind of breathe. Again, not like they're losing faith in him overall, but he has just, he's really struggled, and he's doing some things that he didn't used to do, chasing some pitches he didn't and that sort of thing. So I think it's just a matter of slowing the game down. They moved him down in the order to really take pressure off him. He's been DHing some too, just to keep the pressure off his legs, which have been problematic in the past. But I have a good feeling that he's turning things around and on the verge of it. For your benefit, maybe it won't be against Toronto, but I feel like he's getting close.
Well, I think it is hard, I think, for Jays fans to forget a guy who hit a three-run bomb in a playoff game, right? But he's one of those guys, Brandon, who's always seemed like on the cusp of becoming a star. Like, he's right there every year, tabbed to be a breakout candidate, and then for whatever reason, one reason or another, does not get there. So I am curious to see what he looks like. I'm also curious to see, and we'll see if he's in the lineup tonight, but what Brooks Lee looks like. Because, you know, Brooks Lee, I think it's easy to forget he is someone who has been in the majors for less than a year, right? Made his debut just last season and is only 23 years old. I mean, another guy, I think, popularly tabbed, if he does become an everyday player, as a breakout candidate. How has Brooks Lee looked so far?
You know, he's been all right. I think he's looked better than we expected defensively when he's filled in at shortstop, both when Correa was out and then ejected for the first time in his major league career a couple games ago, which that was interesting to say the least. But Brooks doesn't strike out. He's taking his walks, and the batted ball stuff, the stats may not be all that exciting, but you've got the feeling of a guy who knows the zone, can make contact. And I think at that point, it's just a matter of figuring out what pitchers are trying to do to you and combating that, you know, getting out and being in front of all that as opposed to reacting to it. I have the utmost faith he could be. The name I come back to is like a Jason Kipnis type hitter, right? You know, a very good player, not necessarily a Hall of Famer, maybe might sneak in an all-star bit here or there. But if Jason Kipnis could play a little shortstop, that's a pretty dang good player.
Speaking of good players, and you mentioned Carlos Correa there, kind of a slow start to the season. He seemed to pick it up and then just sat the past two games, kind of like a late scratch situation with some back tightness. What's the concern level there? Do we expect to see him in this series?
Yeah, the public statement was, don't like the batter's box dirt in Sacramento. It's too loose, whatever. Again, we'll all be waiting for 2 o'clock, 2:30 to see if he's in the lineup. So I can't say zero concern, but it's fairly low on the list of concerns right now. But again, until you see if he's in that lineup, you can't say zero.
Right. It's a tough guy to miss, right? For sure. The Twins will miss him whenever he's not on the lineup. And one more guy on the pitching side that I wanted to ask you about here is Yoan Duren, who seems to just be on a league of his own. He's on another level. We all knew that he was good. We all knew that he could throw the ball hard. What is it about this season that has his ERA under one at this point?
He lost, if I'm remembering correctly, 12 pounds in the offseason, cut the the junk in his diet, did some intermittent fasting, all stuff that I've heard on the broadcast. And it has just resulted in his stuff being A++. He had one outing when the weather wasn't that great and the fastball was down and people were starting to wonder, because you're always checking velo on guys. But the split that's in the high 90s, I mean, it's an unprecedented repertoire. We've seen guys throw 100 plus. We've seen guys throw a good split. But when you match all that together with solid command and ground ball rate besides, like, he's a rare breed. And I'm glad they have him, because between him and Griffin Jacks, you feel pretty good if you get a lead into the seventh or eighth inning if you're a Twins fan.
Yeah, I think the Jays need to build a lead to the point where they don't see either of those guys if they want to have success in this series, I would think. Also, Brandon, before we let you go, when you look at – you started this conversation by talking about how similar – the Jays are and the Twins are with respect to their different divisions, right? Linda, in terms of games back of the leader, the Twins are six back of the Tigers. The Jays are 5.5 back as we start today of the Yankees. And the Rays are right there with the Jays in this division. And the Guardians and Royals are right there, very more or less, in the AL Central. I got to say, it's pretty fun to see the turnaround in these two divisions, because for a lot of years, I mean, the AL East was the division where, like, it felt like all teams from the wildcard race would be the American League East, and it seems like it is somewhat flipped, at least right now. What is your level of belief that as we go forward into the season, the Twins can stay where they are and keep ahead of both the Guardians and Royals?
I'd say fairly good. I'm always higher on it because I've been watching these prospects, and right. So maybe I let a little bias seep in. But when you've got pitching and pitching depth, you know, not many teams have David Festa, Simeon Woods, Richardson, Zebby Matthews options at their ready 10 miles away. So as much as it stinks to lose Pablo, the Twins are still in respectably good position in that regard. So I still feel like they're going to pitch. Got to find some offense. And honestly, you know, like we've said, Royce Lewis is not going to hit his body weight or lower this season unless the Twins aren't going to let him do that. If it continues, they'll send him out. So between Correa, Buxton, Lewis, not many teams have a three-man leadership group offensively like that too. So there's reasons to believe they'll score runs, they'll prevent runs, and they play respectable enough defense. I think it's a team that could stay on pace. I think the pace right now is something like 89 wins, which should be enough to get you in this AL, which is crazy. The AL is absolutely insane this year. Other than the White Sox, even the Orioles are creeping back into it, as you guys are probably well aware. So it's going to be a wild race, and I'm just hoping for chaos. I don't want peace. I want problems.
That's such a good way to look at it, and it kind of plays into my last question for you, which is, a lot is being said about the NL West. Is that the best division in baseball? Well, the AL Central, if not the best division in baseball, it certainly looks like the most chaotic division in baseball. Yeah. What is life like in the AL Central these days?
Every night you're hoping for someone to lose, knowing that there's probably somebody playing each other, and so they can't both lose. And then Detroit never loses, I think, notwithstanding here recently. But yeah, it's, again, if you like good baseball and can not have your mind set on if your team doesn't win that it wasn't good baseball, it's a really good time to be an AL Central watcher. But yeah, everyone's chasing the Tigers. Everyone's looking up at the Tigers. And I tell you what, AJ Hinch has been a tremendous stabilizing force at the top of that organization, and they follow suit. He's got Javi Baez swinging it. It's tough. And just like the Jays are looking up at the Yankees.
That's going to be very interesting. The parallels between these two teams are just insane. Brandon, thank you so much for doing this. We wish you all the best. And good luck. Good luck this weekend.
Be good.
All right, there he goes. That's Locked On Twins Podcast's Brandon Warn. He also has a Substack, Access Twins. A lot of good stuff from Brandon. This is going to be a big series. I know that every series is big. Show when you are in the middle of a division race like the Twins and the Blue Jays are, but it does seem like whenever these two teams meet, there's always chance for some mess of any kind, and that starts tonight.
Yeah, I'm curious to see what this bullpen day looks like. We talked about it earlier, but Schultz, probably Lauer later on in a bulk role. I'm curious to see if the Jays can continue to, using air quotes here, but continue to win their bullpen starts. And then you have Kevin Gausman going against the Twins. And I'm really looking forward to that because Gausman, on one hand, has been very, very good in his last three, four outings or so. And on the other hand, the Twins seem to have had his number, right? So I'm curious to see what that looks like. And then on the and then to wrap up the series, you have Baden Francis pitching against Joe Ryan, who, to Brandon's point, has been very good. So I think, like, not that, and again, I think Brandon brings up something valid at the end there by saying, like, even if you don't win, if you're getting certain results, even if you get edged in certain games, you can still view that as positives. And I know that's viewed as more moral victories. You want actual notches in the win column, for sure. But it's going to be a fascinating series against a Twins lineup that had everything working right for it. I mean, they got absolutely annihilated by the A's yesterday, so we'll see what it looks like. But yeah, I'm very much looking forward to life in the AL Central, what it looks like for the Twins as well. Because, you know, we brought up that question with Brandon. So you had the Twins at 34-28. The Tigers are leading the division at 41-23. The Guardians are 33-28, but they also have a minus run differential, a total run differential of minus 17. Yeah. And I've heard before people say run differential can tell you a lot about where your team is at. And I mean, the Jays, I think after last night, I think they're after at a minus one run differential. So they're almost exactly even after some pretty big results, which is, I think, is a positive considering they were like minus 30 at one point. So you definitely take that. But I wonder how sustainable life is in the American League Central for teams like the Royals and the Guardians, and certainly a bit better for the Twins.
It's pretty funny that with the way that the season started for the Twins, we weren't even considering them contenders.
Right.
And then they just out of the blue won 13 games in a row, and they still were very far from the division lead. I think they were at third at that point. So, and even John Schneider said something like, listen, if you win so-and-so games in a row and you're in third place, you know that it's a tough division, right? And so as you look at wild card race and the fact that, listen, the Blue Jays are still going to try, I guess, to catch up to the Yankees here. I don't see the Yankees slowing down unless something, you know, really, really weird happens. But they're going to need everything that they can get here, Sho. And, you know, going back to that text line question from earlier, those surprising players, those guys that are coming in seemingly from out of nowhere, are also going to be important. We know that they're going to go as far as Vlad and Bo and Kirk, Santander, certainly Varsho take them. But then the role players are also important. When you look at the Twins, when you look at the injuries to the rotation and the fact that, you know, they're trying to churn out some innings here and keep going, that is where, you know, all 26 and more kind of come into play. And listen, maybe on Monday, I'm just going to, you know, spin this forward a little bit.
Okay.
But maybe on Monday, we will revisit the conversation of who's been the most surprising player for the Blue Jays so far. Maybe we'll read some texts about it. So if you want to text in at 590-590, let us know. What's your sort of, what's your pick for the most surprising Blue Jays player?
Did you have one when we talked to Mitch? Did you pick one? I don't remember.
Say it's Yariel Rodriguez.
Okay.
Still, I mean, he's been so good in that high leverage role, so much so that we're talking about him maybe closing games if Jeff Hoffman is down. And so that's a pretty big deal. I'd say that's pretty surprising. We didn't really know what to expect from him in that move from the pen. Do you have someone that you, you know?
That's a good question. I think, I mean, Mitch picked Kirk, and I think Kirk might have been mine. But if I can't pick Kirk, I think I might pick Addison Barger.
Yeah.
Because Barger, I think we are seeing, like, the rubber meet the road here with results versus metrics.
Absolutely.
Finally, right? Because for a couple of years, he was that guy who had all of the sexy results in every possible metric, and then he'd come up to the plate, and it'd be a pop-up or a strikeout. And that's not a criticism of Barger necessarily. It's just that he hadn't quite put it together, which, you know, let's face it, many prospects never do, right? And I think it remains to be seen if he's going to do this in a sustainable fashion. But I also said that a month ago, and he's been able to do it still. So I've been very impressed with Barger. I mean, he's been able to do it defensively, whether he's in right field or third base. And he's been mashing the ball. If you look at his Baseball Savant page, it is blood red.
Yeah.
And that's how good it is. So I've been very impressed. He probably is my pick if I'm going to not be a follower and pick Kirk.
He's probably going to be back in the lineup today as well, as the Blue Jays start this three-game set against the Twins. First pitch goes tonight at 8:10 Eastern, Minneapolis, an hour of difference there. And we're obviously going to have it all for you on Sportsnet, on the radio network, on Sportsnet as well. Show, this was pretty fun. Let's
just pretty fun.
Well, it
not
was
really
very fun.
Oh, okay, all right. I'll take that. I'll take very fun.
We will. We'll wrap it up here by saying again, Paxton Schultz starting today. He will make his 7th appearance of the season. He has a 1.84 ERA. He's going against Bailey Ober. The Blue Jays have seen a bit of Ober. Not that much. Ernie Clement is the guy who has somewhat of a successful outing against him with he's going 2-for-7 with a home run. Again, not huge sample sizes, but the Blue Jays go in trying to keep in a good role here. The Twins trying to make up ground in a very difficult division. That's it for us. Thank you to Sho Ali. Thanks to Gord Ash, Mitch Bannon, and Brandon Warren. Amit Mon, Jake Schultz, and Jennifer Rolnick behind the glass. I'm Julia Kreutz. This has been Blue Jays Talk Plus. Blake Murphy will be back on Monday, and we're going to break down everything that happens on this weekend series against the Twins in Minnesota. We'll talk to you later.